close to your mouth.
Okay, oh, that's better. I'll begin again. Hello again. And I want to thank you all for coming tonight, particularly at this busy time of year when we all have so much to do. And thank you for inviting me to have this conversation with you. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to begin by telling you a little bit about myself and about my journey. And after that, I'll share with you some of my thoughts on a few things that we all struggle with, and is the subject of my recent book, written for those of us who have depression or bipolar disorder. I'd like to ask you to please bear with me for using my notes. Those of you familiar with mood disorders know how it tweaks one's memory. And rather than my rambling on and on and on, you and I will both be happier tonight if I refer to them. So thank you. My new book, entitled Take Control of Your Depression, Strategies to Help You Feel Better Now, is a very practical and concise manual about the things that we all need to pay attention to in order to get us through the episodes of a mood disorder. It begins with the basics of mental health, which are regular sleep, healthy diet, daily physical exercise, having a routine and structure to each day, avoiding isolation and taking our medications as prescribed, things that we've all heard about before. My book also includes the fundamentals of CBT with some CBT exercises, finding your baseline self, which is a new exercise, some communication skills, dealing with friends and family, which is a big issue for many of us, and other topics. It also has a number of new and interesting sections, such as depression does not define you, and the use of technology and social media in mental health. So to begin, why should you listen to me? Well, I bridge that space between being a recipient and a provider of mental health services. And that gives me a very unique perspective. I can speak from firsthand experience, backed by medical evidence, about what things are like and what really helps. I'm a very long-term patient, and I don't mind the word patient, with a long personal history of depression on the bipolar spectrum. I'm the author of 3 books on managing depression, as well as a blog on depression. I'm a certified peer specialist who facilitates a support group here at McLean, and I just so happen to be a physician as well. I had my first episodes of depression as a teenager, then on and off for years, but it all went untreated until about 19 years ago. It just wasn't done, at least not in my family. One did not run to doctors for problems with life. Later, it was fear of stigma and losing my job that just got in the way of my seeking professional treatment. That wasn't smart or logical, but it was very real. Then at age 45 in 1998, I had 2 major life losses, and I began treatment with a hormone medication, and all of that precipitated a very severe, incapacitating depression, which lasted years, basically until now. I became very ill, was unable to sleep, function, communicate, concentrate, focus, work, shower. I was curled up in a corner with a blanket over my head, and that's not an exaggeration. I was quite isolated, very withdrawn and suicidal. Since then, I've had more than 50 well-considered medication trials, both conventional and non-conventional, where we were thinking out of the box. More than 40 inpatient hospitalizations over a 10-year period, and 4 months of the partial hospitalization program at McLean, with many years of psychotherapy in between, both individual and group. I've had a course of ECT and participated in the clinical trial with a vagus nerve stimulator implant, which, for those of you who may know, is like a pacemaker for the mood center of your brain. I had that in for 10 years. All along, I had an awesome treatment team who held hope for me when I had absolutely none. I could not see the tunnel, let alone the light at the end of the tunnel. But I respected my treatment team, and I figured they're no fools, so I believed in them, just a little bit. Improvement took a very long time for me, and along the way, I was sidetracked by a number of medical misadventures, such as breast cancer, followed by a hip dislocation 3 months after having hip replacement treatment or therapy, a broken ankle that didn't heal for a year, a blood clot in my lung called pulmonary embolism, followed by two huge blood clots in my right leg. All of that happened in the course of 4 years. We all thought I'd have a major meltdown, but surprisingly, somehow I didn't. I did pretty well, thanks in part to the fact that you get greater support from friends and family from physical medical problems when you have these kind of issues versus depression. I learned that nobody brings casseroles for depression. I've been in front of you before, and with this new book, there are a few different topics that I'd like us to think about and talk about tonight. First, there's the fear of getting better. Huh? Not me. What do you mean by that? Well, sometimes with a long-standing illness like depression, bipolar disorder, or anxiety, the idea of feeling better or good or improvement might seem strange and uncomfortable at first. It might not even be on our radar. For this reason, some of us might have an underlying fear of getting better, a fear of recovery. Now, how can this be? Isn't that the ultimate goal, to feel better? Well, here's the idea. When we're immersed in a mood disorder for a very long time, the illness causes us to have a changed view of ourselves and to adopt certain depressive behaviors that then become very familiar to us. As we get used to living within the episode of depression, these depressed thoughts and actions become our new sense of normal. So then, going back to feeling good the way it was way back when becomes strange and may cause a person to feel uncomfortable at first. Since we've been so depressed for a long time and we're not used to feeling good, that might make us feel anxious or irritable. The depressed brain sees feeling good as different and not right. So the tendency is to want to go back to the thoughts, feelings, and behaviors of depression irritability or anxiety. Feeling depressed may feel safer and more comfortable than risking the new territory of wellness, which has a different and healthier set of feelings, thoughts, and behaviors. So we tend to gravitate back towards the negative and down moods of depression. Getting better also means leaving behind the familiar illness and life as you know it now, and venturing into the world of wellness that's probably uncertain and unfamiliar to you, as it was to me. That can be scary. A person might feel anxious, irritable, and want to retreat back to your old depressed self. You don't know what to expect, especially if you had trouble remembering what you were like before the depression began. And that's a pretty common thing. So some people might feel more comfortable keeping things just as they are, staying in the old familiar depression. I urge you not to do this, not to allow that to happen. So how do you avoid this trap? For one thing, it's helpful to remind yourself of your goals in life, things you have always wanted to do, such as finishing school or a favorite project, taking a trip, completing a 5K, reading a book, things you can't accomplish very well in a depressed or withdrawn and isolated state. And don't be afraid to reach out and try new things or a new way of doing something that you've always done the old way. And here's where the principles of distress tolerance and managing anxiety by using your coping strategies can become useful. Some might fear that when depression symptoms improve or go away, they won't know how to go through life in any other way. You will, though, because along the way, you will have learned to replace the depressive symptoms and thoughts with a more positive review of yourself. And in my new book, I talk about ways to address these fears. Now, the next thing I'd like us to think about is the question, what is the goal? What are we doing here? We know we all feel lousy. So why do we keep going to appointments and agree to treatment? I don't know. Well, what we all want is to feel better. But what is better? To most of us, it means that the symptoms of depression or anxiety or bipolar disorder have gone away. Yet, the absence of symptoms is not enough for us to feel well. Being totally without symptoms is a false goal. It leaves us feeling empty and will not bring us the relief we strive for. So the answer to the question, what is the goal, really should be, wellness is the goal. Okay. So what exactly is wellness? Well, being well is not only freedom from the symptoms or episodes of a mood disorder. Being well is an ongoing process that includes participating in the world around you, where you get involved in life and don't just sit back passively. I know that's really hard to do when you're depressed, though. Being well means being in control of your life and the way it's going, and making decisions for yourself, not being controlled by someone else. Being well includes having a sense of personal growth by using your own unique skills and talents to their best. It means having interpersonal relationships that matter to you. Being well means that you have a sense of competence and mastery in the things you do in your life, and that you feel good about who you are. This leads to a feeling of self-confidence and self-respect and pride in your accomplishments, no matter how small. Seems like a long list, but there are 6 main parts to wellness. It's not easy to achieve them all at once, and nobody tries to do that, particularly when you're depressed. But it is possible to aim for them. Excuse me 1 minute. I suggest you aim for one part at a time. Slowly, then you begin to work on another part. So the 6 parts of wellness are having a purpose in life, feeling that your life has meaning and direction. This could come from what you do in your role in your family, at work or school, in your community, or as a volunteer, in your neighborhood, in your church or social groups. For example, your purpose in life might be as a parent raising healthy children, as a student working towards mastering some academic material, as a paid or volunteer worker contributing something, as a daughter or son caring for elderly parents. The next part of wellness is living a life based on your own personal convictions, beliefs, opinions, principles. It means you drive the course of your life. You're free to make decisions for yourself and are not controlled by somebody else. Another part of wellness is making use of your own personal talents and potential to contribute and create something. The next point is managing your life situations well. In whatever positive or negative life events happen to you along the way. The 5th point is having positive relationships with deep ties to other people, both intimate relationships and casual relationships. And the last part of wellness is accepting yourself, having knowledge and acceptance of who you are as a person, including your own limitations, strengths, and weaknesses. Now, this all seems quite daunting, but an assortment of some of these skills in these different areas will lead you to a sense of wellness and well-being, and will do far more than just the absence of a depression symptom or a bipolar symptom. Now, the final topic I'd like to talk about tonight that comes from my book is how to survive the upcoming holidays with family and friends. That's a big issue for lots of people. During the holidays, many of us are surrounded by people and environments who are wrapped up in the joy and the chaos of this season. Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, Christmas, New Year's, Kwanzaa, you just can't seem to escape it. Everywhere you go, there are decorations and holiday music playing from September until January. In the malls, at CVS, and the grocery store. If you're suffering from depression or bipolar disorder, this can be quite stressful and irritating. You may feel pressure to participate in these activities, either from within yourself or from family members, at a time when you least feel like it. Holidays impact us in many ways. For one thing, they're an upset to our daily routine, our usual days, with gift buying, grocery shopping, gift wrapping, cooking and baking, preparing special meals for our family and friends, or planning and preparing and having get-togethers. Maybe going to holiday shows, listening to different music, those kinds of things. Just that change in our daily routine can sometimes be a problem for those of us who have a mood disorder. It can be quite disruptive. And deep down inside, we might be conflicted about whether we even want to do any of those things. Holiday stress often begins with a should list that's bound to get anybody into trouble. I should do this, I should make that, or I should go here or there. That resonates with many of us. It happens even when we don't feel like it, or have the time or energy to do so. Holidays lead us to take on an overload of responsibilities, and then we feel guilty if we can't live up to the shoulds. Then there are the holiday expectations. Expectations are tricky. During the holidays, they often appear as an artificial set of standards that you impose on yourself. Or maybe your family does. And they're usually based on some unreachable ideal that you see in a magazine, on television, or the internet. Or maybe on what your great-grandmother was reportedly said to have done. Make this, bake that, put on that holiday party. Trying to reach these unrealistic expectations will only bring you disappointment and more stress, not pleasure. It puts a lot of pressure on us. You have to remember, holidays are not a competitive sport. We don't compare ourselves to each other. Sometimes when depressed, the reverse can happen. And you might not feel like doing any holiday preparations at all. And then you feel enormously guilty later on for ignoring your loved ones. So instead, try to think about where you are with your depression at this moment and what you can realistically do now for yourself and your family. Do what you can realistically do and enjoy the time you have together, which is all that really matters anyway. And learn to say no when you have to. Another source of stress is the actual act of getting together with family members or friends. It may not always go as you like. And in your mind, you may have images of others having idyllic festivities with their families. But this isn't an accurate picture of real life, so try not to make comparisons. Some of your family members might be close and supportive, which is good. But others may know exactly how to push your buttons. When are you going to get a real job? Or a boyfriend? Or cut your hair? Or dress better? You probably heard it all. Other relatives you might not have seen in a long time, and you may feel you no longer have much in common with them. So you feel it's an obligation to spend time with them and not a joy of the season. So this is where you have to pick and choose how to spend your time and with whom. Another thing is that friends and relatives tend to have different viewpoints, knowledge, and understanding of mood disorders. And they may not be as supportive or understanding as you'd like or need them to be. So sometimes you might need to step back and realize that you may never be able to change the other person's opinion. And then limit your conversations with them to other topics, not your illness. If your interactions with them still cause you stress or distress, it's probably best to limit the amount of contact you have with this person, even if it is the holiday season. So what things can you do to deal with the holidays? First, aim for small and realistic and attainable goals. This includes shopping for gifts and cooking and decorating and the parties and the get-togethers. And you don't have to do it all. There's no shoulds in your vocabulary. Keep up with your usual schedule of daily activities, including your diet, nutrition, sleep, physical activities, exercise, self-care. Don't forget any of that. Try to prioritize your responsibilities and activities, and try not to overschedule if it's possible. A lot of people find it helpful to keep a calendar and use post-it notes and make lists of what you have to do. Avoid the shoulds, as we talked about, and just replace them with I would like, such as I would like to knit that scarf for my niece for Hanukkah, or I would like to bake those cookies for the church bazaar, if you can. Enjoy the holiday food, but don't overeat and be sorry later. And take a step back and learn to say no when you need to. Now, what if you're among those people who don't have a large network of family or friends to surround you? That happens to some. First thing is to ask yourself who it is that you know well, personally, and what your relationships with them are. Here's where the quality of friendship wins over the number of friends that you have. And remind yourself you're not alone in this situation. Then make an effort to connect with the network of friends that you do have. Get together a little bit more often for brief times, maybe a quiet lunch or a walk around the block. And another thing to try is just to reach out to those who are in need during the holidays. Many volunteer organizations would love to have your help in what they do. And that often brings greater rewards back to you. You could be pleasantly surprised. And remember, you will get through the holidays. January will come. I thank you for your time tonight. Now, we have about 15 minutes or so for questions. And before we get to the questions, I just want to let you know I do have my books here, and I have a coupon. If anybody is interested in my recent one, there's a coupon where you can get it online. So you can come up to the table and get that afterwards. And yes, should we switch mics?
Yeah, switch mics.
Okay.
Testing. Is this working?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Really close.
Okay. Okay. Wait, it's not. Okay. Is that working?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and all the personal aspects of things you've been through. You've been through a lot, and you're doing a lot of good with it by writing these books and sharing your story. How do you access your blog?
My blog is both on my own website, which is SusanNoonanMD.com, or on Psychology Today. You can go to Psychology Today and just look me up under their website.
How do you spell your last name?
N-O-O-N-A-N.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Yes.
Thank you. Do you have anything in particular to advise for those of us who suffer really badly from winter depression? So all of the treatment I get for my depression, which is extensive, doesn't affect the winter depression.
Are you talking specifically about seasonal affective disorder?
Yes.
Ah, okay. Well, there are a lot of people who do experience... I'll actually address it in two ways. There are people who experience a depression throughout the year, which then becomes seemingly worse around the holidays or worse with the shorter days and with the winter season. And then there are people who experience depression primarily with the shorter days and the shorter daylight, and that's seasonal affective disorder.
I have depression all year long, lifelong.
Okay.
But it's very much different and worse as soon as the light starts lessening.
It's a tough question. Yes, did you have trouble hearing it?
No, I just wanted to comment. But it gets a lot worse in the winter, but I use like a vitro light, right? To kind of like simulate the sun, and I like sit near it for a good 45 minutes a day. It makes a big difference. It feels good to sit here. Like, I can't really explain it, but I use a grow light.
I have one, thank you. I do use it.
Yes.
It's very marginally effective in my case.
You want to make sure that you are in treatment. You want to make sure that you do get outside to get natural light, as well as using the indoor artificial light to extend the period of light exposure, such as what this gentleman described. And that you're maximizing your treatment modalities otherwise, because this is a really difficult problem that we have, particularly in the Northeast, when our days are shorter and it gets darker and it's cold and it's just a very tough time. And then the holidays also factor into that and become, you know, difficult for a lot of people, as well as the days getting shorter and darker and things just seem grim in general. I don't have any magic solution to it, however. I'm really sorry to have to report that. I don't look forward to the end of November and December every year myself, although I don't specifically have that particular issue. I have a 12-month kind of pattern to my own problems, but I can empathize with your problem. Yes, somebody in the back.
One thing you might want to do is go out after it snows, because if it's really a lot of sun and everything like that, reflecting off the snow, that gives more light. But the danger there is that sometimes that can turn to mania. It might have happened in my case.
Okay. I see. Well, thank you for sharing. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
I have a question on a more personal note. How did you get over the fear of disclosing your illness professionally?
That's a great question. When I first went into treatment and it was recommended that I go to groups, I was mute for about 3 years. I sat in groups and did not say a word. I was just unable to disclose it to anybody in groups, let alone to any of my friends or colleagues. Although my closest friends knew, of course, they were very aware of it. And I was totally afraid of any professional contacts finding out about it and knowing it. And gradually, I became more comfortable speaking, and it was kind of positive reinforcement. The kinds of things I would be very select in what I would say, and I found that other people found what I, the few things I said to be helpful, so that then reinforced me to say a little bit more and say a little bit more. And then somehow or other, I had this great big stack of notes that I had taken because I had to write everything down. I could not remember a darn thing. And I was trying to organize them and organize them in the computer. The notes were all from the various seminars and classes that I took on depression. And I was trying to organize them for myself, but they took a form of a book and they became the first book. So the first book I submitted to the publisher, and then they agreed to publish it within the 3 days. And I thought, uh-oh, the cat's out of the bag. Now, my professional colleagues will know. Maybe I can publish it anonymously or use a different name, or maybe I don't have to say I had depression on the back of the book. I can say something else inside. I knew somebody who had depression. Well, that didn't work very well. So I kind of just slid under the door that way. And then I found out that people were very understanding. And they were not judgmental, and they were not critical, and they were turned out to be very supportive. So it was a long lesson that I learned over many years, and I learned that my fears were not substantiated. So it took me a long time.
Any other questions? Okay, well, let's thank